Good evening, and welcome to our virtual town hall on the Affordable Care Act. I'm Laura Canoy. Today's broadcast is a collaboration between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Live for Your Die Alliance, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that serves New Hampshire citizens by providing civil exchanges on a variety of New Hampshire issues. We're live in our Studio D here at NHPR and streaming on NHPR.org. And today we're asking the question, will the Affordable Care Act make care affordable for Granite Staters, and if so, for whom? We have a panel of experts on this topic, and I'm also joined by Tiffany Eddy, who will be sharing questions that you've submitted by email, Facebook, and Twitter, along with questions from our live audience. There's still time to get your thoughts and questions in. You can send those to townhall@nhpr.org, send a tweet to @NHPR with the hashtag ACATownHall, or post a question on Facebook at NH Public Radio or Live for Your Die Alliance. We have four guests to talk about this topic today, starting from my right, Lisa Girton, president of Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield in New Hampshire. We have Lisa Kaplan Howe, policy director for New Hampshire Voices for Health, a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. Next to her is Steve Gerlach, a tax attorney at Bernstein Schur. He represents businesses in matters pertaining to the Affordable Care Act. And finally, Rachel Verville. She's vice president of revenue cycle at Elliott Hospital. All of you, welcome, and let's jump right into it. And the name of the law, as we all know, is the Affordable Care Act, but a lot of concern we're hearing these days that it is not turning out to be affordable for a lot of folks. All four of you, I want to just go down the line if I could, please. Lisa Girton, you first. What are you most worried about with this, especially as we approach 2014?
Well, I guess 2 points. One is the question of affordability. Certainly, I think the people that will be getting a subsidy to help them pay for their insurance premium for the first time will find greater affordability. And we've been working hard to make sure there are high-value options for people who aren't getting a subsidy as well. I'm not worried. I think that all of us that are attached to this huge undertaking are anxious for the day when everything works perfectly end-to-end. It would be disingenuous to say otherwise. But I'm not worried, and I actually hope by sharing some information here tonight with consumers about options that are available and opportunities to get out and look at those options, people will be a little less worried overall because we do have some time, and I think, you know, things will settle down and they'll be able to get enrolled.
Okay, and I've got a couple follow-ups for you, but okay. I'll go down the line. Lisa Kaplan Howe, what are you worried about as this approaches? Your organization was a big supporter of the Affordable Care Act.
Sure. So I would just start by pointing out something that a lot of people don't think and talk about, but the name of the law is actually the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So affordability is certainly something that I think across the board we all, you know, want to see happen, and it's a priority for all of us, but it's a piece of the law. I would say particularly if you look at both sides of the equation, the premiums, but also the value that your health plan brings and how well it's going to do in covering the health care you need, that we are definitely moving in the right direction. And I would also say that I don't have necessarily concerns, more a hope that people are starting to get a better sense and a clearer sense of what their options are for 2014 and have the information they need to know to make the best decision for them.
So not worried?
No, not worried. And I think part of that is because we're seeing more and more information getting out there and people getting a clearer view, better understanding of what their choices are and what their choices will mean for them.
And Steve Gerlach, as I said, you work with businesses. What are you hearing from them? Are they worried about this?
Many are. Many are. I have a couple of concerns with respect to that. I work with employers, both nonprofit and for-profit employers. The primary one is that still there appears to be a lack of factual, actionable information for employers to get out there, stuff they can use and take back to their workplaces and know what to do. That's a concern of mine. The small group market, most of the reforms that are coming into play in 2014 that affect employers are affecting those in the small group market and fundamentally changing the way the rating system in that market. If Massachusetts is any indicator, this is going to drive up the premiums in that market. And the carriers are already adapting to that by offering early renewals and so forth. But ultimately, these changes are going to come into effect. And then lastly, I do have a concern that the larger employers not put off their compliance efforts for the employer mandate that that does come into effect on January 1, 2015, because the decisions they make now will definitely affect both their compliance and costs going forward.
So even though they have another year now under that recent decision, you're saying don't sit back and wait.
That's right. They should use that year.
Yeah. How about you, Rachel? Concerns, worries, anxieties looking ahead?
I would say more a call to action from on behalf of our patients. What I'm most concerned about is the confusing information or the fact that this can be very confusing for our patients who are trying to navigate what's a very complex environment, an environment that they may never have had to navigate before. So we have been working hard on our financial advocacy program at Elliott Health System in an effort to help patients navigate what their options are. And, you know, something Lisa said earlier resonated with me in terms of making sure they understand the value of what their health plan choice is. So not just premiums, but also out-of-pocket costs and all the nuances of healthcare. The Elliott has become a certified application counselor site under CMS so that we do have a little bit more information and we're taking the knowledge that we're gaining from that activity to our patients. But it is confusing for them. It's a lot to digest. And certainly at times when a patient is accessing the healthcare system, it's difficult to wrap your head around a health insurance situation when you're trying to access care at the same time. So it's something that we're focused very, very closely on right now.
A couple quick follow-ups for all of you, and then I want to go to my colleague Tiffany Eddy with lots of great questions that we got from our listeners, from members of Live for Your Die Alliance. And Lisa Girton, to you first, the narrow network that Anthem announced recently as a way to control costs has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of it negative. Do you regret taking that policy approach, Lisa, of offering this narrow network of providers?
No, I really don't. And it has gotten a lot of attention. We recognize that it represents a change and that change is hard. I do believe because we spent so much time talking to consumers and trying to understand what would be important to them when 2014 finally got here under the Affordable Care Act, and it was so resounding that affordability was the number one concern. And we also asked about trading off network breadth if there were a corresponding decrease in the premium, and they said that they would take that trade-off. And so the reason I feel that we did the right thing is because we asked the consumers and tried to build a product that they would value. I do think it's high value. It is narrower, but not especially narrow, especially when you look at the physician side and how many of the state's PCPs will participate, how many of the state's specialists will participate. And so we're very hopeful that as people are now able to get out and take a look at it, they will see that it is a high-value product and maybe a very good option for them.
How do you feel about the backlash that you got in the legislature a couple weeks back on this?
Well, the phrase "no good deed goes unpunished" comes to mind every once in a while because we were the only ones, as I'm sure you all know, who decided to be on the exchange this year. And so I understand both that magnifies concerns because our offering is the only one that's available for people getting a subsidy. But again, I also believe that we did the right thing, and I believe ultimately the consumers will tell us that by buying it or not buying it.
Lisa Kaplan Howe, a question for you. Again, you and I have had a lot of conversations about the Affordable Care Act, patient protection and Affordable Care Act, as you said. But one of the big disappointments, as you know, was the rollout of these healthcare exchanges or marketplaces. You know, the law is really, in large measure, based on this, and it was a mess up. I just wonder, as an advocate of this, what do you say about that?
Certainly, we share everybody's frustration, and we were all there probably contributing in part to the problem on day one trying to get on. I think what I take to heart is two things, or actually three things. One is that it is a piece of the law. It's not the entire law. It's a piece of the law. But as you say, a very important piece of the law. What we've seen in the last month plus is that there are other venues for people getting into the system and through the system, and those seem to be working for people using the call center. And over the last week and a half, things have really been improving. And, you know, it started with one anecdote in the hallway that one of the navigator organizations mentioned to us, and it's really just been confirmed time and time again that we are seeing improvement. And so that gives me hope as we start inching closer to December 15th. But I don't think anybody would say that they've been pleased with how things have been going.
Were you surprised? I mean, it's 2013. It's a website. I mean, it's not, you know, at this point, it's not rocket science. It's a website.
Well, it's a pretty involved website. There needs to be communications internally to be matching and verifying data, and then communications with health plans. And so while it's just a website, I think it's a much more involved website than many websites are. The other thing that I think we all need to be aware of, and this doesn't excuse it, nor does it make up for it, but it's not like it was an easy road for them to move forward on implementation. There were constant challenges and barriers brought up, whether it be in D.C. at the congressional level, whether it be holding back money or, you know, putting challenges to the implementation. So while they had time, they had a lot of challenges. Now, again, none of us are happy with how it's worked, and that's not an excuse, but it's not like they waited till the last minute and screwed something up. They had a lot of things to contend with.
Steve Gerlach, one issue that I want to ask you about that I've heard a lot about, it's not a pretty word, but dumping. And I'm sure you've heard this too. The concern is that at some point employers will say, either if they have lower income workers, they'll just say, you know, just go on Medicaid. And with the exchanges or the marketplaces, you know, it's cheaper for me just to dump my health care coverage and dump you, employee, on the exchange. It's not a pretty picture, but that's the concern, is that employers are just going to say, eh, forget it. Would you advise them to do that? Just say, put your people on the exchanges. It's not worth it. It's too expensive.
There's a lot of considerations that go into an employer's decision to offer health coverage or not offer health coverage. One of which, a very significant one of those, is cost, but it's not the only one. I believe that if you sit down and you look at the cost of providing coverage to an individual and the cost of paying the penalties, say we're talking about a large employer now, the cost of paying the penalties under the employer mandate, that dollar for dollar, it's going to be less expensive to dump, as you put
it. To pay the penalty.
Right, to pay the penalty. However, the question arises, does the employer feel a moral obligation to provide health coverage to their employees? Many do. Not all, but many do. Will the employer be able to attract the kind of talent that that it needs if it's not offering health coverage? And between those two, most employers are making solid business decisions to continue offering coverage. I do have a few that I work with that are at least seriously considering dumping. But most are not.
And Rachel, a question for you. When the Affordable Care Act was first being talked about, it's hard to believe it's been 3 years since this law was signed. There was a lot of discussion about one way that this was going to help reduce costs was by moving away from the so-called fee-for-service model, which is said to encourage more testing, maybe unnecessary procedures, because that's the payment incentive. 3 years out, I don't see a lot of movement away from that fee-for-service model. What's going on there?
I think we are moving. This is a good, great first step to move from fee-for-service towards fee-for-value. And I think, you know, we're big proponents of that has to be the wave of the future. There has to be really a focus on, instead of just clicks and getting paid for additional things that are done, the payment has to be tied to the value provided to a patient. I do think that this is an important first step in that direction. And one reason for that is the fact that there is a very important component of the Affordable Care Act that really focuses on prevention. And that's a cornerstone to providing good care, to making sure that appropriate vaccinations are given, that screening services, as they're indicated, are performed. Annual physicals are part of the benefit structures under the Affordable Care Act requirements. And I think that is one very important step forward in terms of moving from a fee-for-service world to a fee-for-value value, but we do have a long way to go.
We do. That's what I wanted to ask you. So you're saying moving, but we haven't moved yet.
Right.
Yeah. Here's the quick flip side of this. You know, if you're having some scary headaches or you're having a scary pain in your side, you want that fee-for-service model. You want every last test, every last doctor visit, just to make sure you're not dying of some weird tumor. I mean, fee-for-service gets a bad rap, but sometimes, if you're in a scary situation, you want that double, triple check.
Well, and I think, you know, as the years have gone on, more and more patients are really active participants in their care. And that's a very good thing. But what we always have to make sure is that we're practicing evidence-based medicine and that we're helping to collaboratively work with patients in making care decisions, you know, based on the signs and symptoms and the attempts to diagnose and then treat a patient. And again, that's core to fee-for-value as well.
All right. Well, if you just joined us, go ahead, Lisa, real quick.
Because this is such an important way that we are beginning to change our, our partnership and our collaboration. And I think just the idea that this movement to pay for value is just all about the reimbursement. It's really also about giving tools and information so that care is actually more coordinated. More isn't better if it's uncoordinated. If all you're doing is duplicating the same tests, that isn't necessarily an improvement in care, but it certainly is an increase in cost. And so I think what's so important about this approach is that we're always looking at quality as well as cost and giving physicians new tools to help them identify things like gaps in care when a test should be done. So I understand the concern, but I think you have to look at the program holistically beyond just the way payment is made to understand how it protects against that.
If you just joined us, welcome to a virtual town hall on the Affordable Care Act, a collaboration between NHPR and the Live for Your Die Alliance. And again, we're looking at whether the Affordable Care Act really will make care more affordable. And there's still time to get your questions in. Send them to townhall@nhpr.org. Send a tweet to @NHPR with the hashtag ACA Town Hall. Post a question on Facebook at NH Public Radio or Live for Your Die Alliance. I want to go now to my colleague Tiffany Eddy. She's been collecting and reviewing terrific questions that we've gotten already from our listeners and members. And Tiffany, go ahead, please.
All right. Well, thank you very much. While we're on the subject of cost, this first question comes in from the LFDA Facebook page, and it comes in from a gentleman named Eric Castle, who writes, I thought this ACA was supposed to make health care affordable for everyone. How is it that my high deductible insurance qualifies then? I am responsible for the first $4,000. All my medical bills, even a regular checkup, comes out of pocket. Prescriptions, too, have been paid for with cash or whatever health savings account, HSA. Now, to make things even better, my premium will be going up at the beginning of the year. This is the insurance provided by my place of employment. So his question is about cost. And Lisa Girton, would you mind taking the lead on this question?
No, I wouldn't mind. I'm just wanting to make sure I really understand the core, the sort of crux of the question.
Concerned about high deductibles with his insurance, I think is the juxt of it there.
Well, I think we have definitely seen employers and individuals buying plans with larger deductibles as a trade-off to a lower monthly premium. And as we all know, the Affordable Care Act does require that plans for the small segment of the market as well as individuals be built around actuarial values, which by definition means that out of all the covered services that are included in the plan, there will be either 90%, 80%, 70%, or 60%, that's the platinum, gold, silver, and bronze, paid of those covered services. So that suggests that there is a wide range of out-of-pocket costs that are possible under these plans. And I think the things that make healthcare go up in general, the overall health of the population, the aging of the population, the emergence of expensive new treatments that are life-saving but also have a high price tag, none of that goes away. That's still going on beneath the Affordable Care Act. And so there should be expected to be some increases in cost year over year. I think what we hope is that people will understand their options and look at that trade-off between larger out-of-pocket cost and lower monthly premiums and make a choice that's good for them.
I want to actually ask that question to Rachel, too, if I could. One theory, Rachel, as you know, is that high deductibles mean people have more skin in the game, and that eliminates perhaps overuse of the system. So there's a flip side to that. What do you think? And Lisa Kaplan-Howe, maybe you on that as well.
Sure. I mean, not to overuse the term value, but again, it's part of the way to get a patient to understand the value of the health care that they're receiving as well. So it is important for the patient to participate both in understanding the premiums associated with their plan choices, but also understanding those out-of-pocket costs. It's very important in terms of the decision-making and what plan product might be best for an individual or a family. There are maximums, though, at this point as well. So where in the past there may have been a benefit cap, there are now out-of-pocket maximums, too, that help to protect patients as well. In the preventive care that's provided under these plans also is provided without out-of-pocket costs, and I think that's a really important point for patients and in consumers at large to understand, that those preventive measures are provided without cost to the patient and really are important for keeping the population healthy.
Lisa, if you could address this too, because this gets under both the patient protection part and the affordable part, and the person whose question Tiffany just read is saying, you know, this is still really expensive for me.
And I think his point underscores something that I was saying earlier, that the cost is not just the premium. I think often the price tag feels like the premium, but just having a health insurance card in your pocket doesn't do anything for you if you can't get the health care that you need with that card affordably. So it really is a balance, and it's challenging being in the situation of an employee who doesn't have choices. They're given one choice from their employer. I actually am hopeful that as the years move on, that will change somewhat. And one thing that will be coming down the pike in 2015 through the marketplace is small employers for the first time being able to give their employees a choice of different health plans, and so that the employer kind of gets alleviated from them that burden of finding the one plan that works best for their entire workforce, and hopefully that allows their employees to make a choice that's best for them.
Go ahead, Tiffany, with another question.
All right. Well, we do have a live audience here in our studio right now, and we have asked them to submit their questions. We have a woman here. Would you mind telling me your name, please?
Sure. Happy Beale from Bedford, New Hampshire.
And who's your question directed towards?
I didn't actually have it to a specific person. How about if I throw it out and see where it goes? All right. I'm wondering what will happen to New Hampshire residents who fall within what we call the newly defined poverty range if the legislature decides not to expand Medicaid. From what I've heard, if they try to go to the plan, there's not a plan for them. So anybody who can take that up, what might happen?
Medicaid expansion, huge point. Thank you so much, Lisa, and maybe Steve, you too. Go ahead, Lisa.
Sure.
Lisa Kaplan-Howe.
Sure. So, yeah, that is a big question, and certainly a big question this week while the decision is pending. The way the law was written and the way the law was passed was on the assumption that every state would expand Medicaid because it wasn't an option. And then the Supreme Court case and decision came down and made it an option to states. So we have what is often called the coverage canyon or the coverage chasm that people, the vast majority of people who would be eligible for Medicaid only if we extend the program to all low-income adults won't have other options for financial assistance. They certainly can go and purchase a health plan on their own, but they can't, you know, realistically, they can't afford to do that. So unfortunately, the premium tax credits and cost sharing reductions that are available to slightly higher but still, you know, limited income people weren't made available to that population because the thinking was that they'd be in Medicaid. So that leaves, you know, upwards of potentially 40,000, even more people without a realistic coverage option. And then that reflects back on all of us with insurance because the cost shifting that results from uncompensated care that's been contributing towards premiums for years will continue in some measure as a result.
Steve Gerlach, I love your thoughts on this, too, given that some business groups have come out in favor of Medicaid expansion, thinking that it will help lower costs.
Sure. Simply because if these folks are not covered under Medicaid, then their employers may be required to cover them. under the law, and it shifts an entire group of costs back onto employers that might be taken up by Medicaid instead.
So you're hopeful that this will happen in what way, Steve? Because there's two sort of ways that they're thinking about it: more traditional Medicaid, mm-hmm. and then the idea of using private insurance, letting people shop on the exchanges who fit certain income requirements. Which way do you think would be a better way to go?
So basically making the exchanges available to this group of folks, I think we need to do one or the other. I don't know that I have a preference between the two, mm-hmm. So long as these folks have access to care.
Yeah. What do you think, Lisa? And then maybe you, Rachel, as well. This is a big deal, this Medicaid expansion.
So I think to clarify, either way, it's going to go through private insurance because we are in the middle and nearing the beginning of a transition to Medicaid managed care. So one way or another, these folks are going to be in private insurance plans. It's whether they're through the Medicaid managed care program or through the marketplaces. And I think as long as the right protections are included and the protections of making sure that commercial private insurance is affordable to people at the very bottom of the income range is an important consideration and something that needs to be paid attention to. I think either could work, and I think realistically, probably the way it's going to happen, if it does happen, is that we are going to move toward coverage through the marketplace with significant financial assistance.
Which means these health exchanges need to get up and running.
And they are up and running. Yeah. And I will say on that, people are getting in through the website, and it's going to take time, though, to make that transition because there's a larger transition that needs to happen even at the state level for that partnership between Medicaid, which is a state program, though a federal state partnership, and the marketplace, which is federally facilitated at this point.
Okay. And we have had such a response, again, from our listeners, from our audience. I want to go back to Tiffany Eddy with some more questions.
Absolutely. And if anyone in the audience wants to ask a question, just raise your hands and I will come over and visit you. This question came in via email, and the question is for the panel. This person writes in, one of the factors that drives excellence in education, sports, and especially business is competition. If we encouraged more competition, say allowing people to buy health insurance in a national market across state lines, would that create more affordable and higher quality options for consumers?
Big issue. Should we go? I think we should go down the line on that one because, yeah, we've gotten a lot of questions from people about that. Lisa Girton, would more competition in New Hampshire help? We don't have that many health insurers in this state.
Right. Well, I think it is not a straightforward economic principle. While in general, in your Economics 101 class, they will say that competition is you know, absolutely key to low prices. I'm not suggesting that more competition wouldn't be good for New Hampshire consumers in terms of having choice, but in terms of having an immediate impact on lowering the premiums of health insurance, that's where the economic principle doesn't hold up very well. Because in fact, in some environments, when there is a more fragmented insurance market, those insurers then don't have the leverage to try to negotiate the best possible discounts for their customers. So again, it is not a straightforward economic principle as it is in so many parts of our economy. And I don't think it's the magic bullet.
Yeah, we did get a lot of questions about that, though, and I want to hear from all of you on this, and then I'll go back to Tiffany for more audience reaction. Go ahead, Lisa Kavanaugh.
Sure. So I would definitely agree that I think competition functions differently in healthcare, both on the insurer side and the provider side, than it does in so many industries. Certainly, from my perspective, having more options, having meaningful choice, so not being overwhelmed by options, but having more options would be helpful, and certainly having some competition would be helpful. But I think it matters what type of competition we're talking about. So having more insurers in the state would be great. When you start talking about having people buy insurance that's not licensed by the state and doesn't meet all the same requirements, then you get into a situation which probably we don't want to dive too far into details on, but you've got adverse selection and you've got really a segmenting of the market that could make good quality insurance even more expensive.
Go ahead, Steve Gerlach, please.
Sure. I generally agree with what both of the previous panelists have said, and I would add that the state of Massachusetts has published an August report on its healthcare market, now 7 years out from the passage of what's become known as RomneyCare. And so we do have a little bit of factual information about what the effects of that have been in the Massachusetts market. Generally speaking, this is very broad brush, but generally speaking, the premiums on the individual market have come down because there are more people in that market now. And the general trend has been for the so-called young invincibles have been signing up. It's my understanding that that's not been the case so far on the national level, but that may just be it's a little early in the game to tell. Different story in the large and very large group market who seem to be trending along with the national rate of inflation. And then the small group market, as I mentioned before, the costs have gone up in the small group market. That's not necessarily to do with the competition, but rather the way that the rating system has changed.
Yeah, go ahead, Rachel.
You know, all good points, and they all resonate with me in terms of the other panelists. What I would say is unlimited choice would just add to patient confusion. If you're talking about multiple insurance carriers with multiple plans across state lines trying to sell insurance to consumers in the marketplace, that could be a really intimidating situation. You know, there's an expectation that when we hit 2015, there'll be additional plan choices in the marketplace. Our Harvard Community Health Plan is contemplating going in that direction, and I think that will make it the more robust choice would certainly be a nice thing. But I would agree with all the points that having unlimited access to various plans across state lines, you know, could have some unintended consequences there and be very confusing.
Again, this is a special broadcast. We're looking at whether the Affordable Care Act will make care more affordable. If you've just joined us, this is a collaboration between NHPR and the Live Free or Die Alliance. Still time to get your questions in. Send them to townhall@nhpr.org. Send a tweet to @NHPR with the hashtag ACATownHall. Post a question on Facebook at NH Public Radio or Live Free or Die Alliance. By the way, you can also check out our digital journalist Brian Walston's piece called Obamacare, Tales from the Front Lines. It's a great summary. Includes lots of personal stories from Granite Staters. You can find that on our website at nhpr.org. And Tiffany, Eddie, back to you, please.
All right. Well, this question comes in from the audience. They asked me if I would pose this to the panelists. They ask, in the spirit of healthcare reform, why can't the insurance company and hospitals meet halfway with respect to provider networks? Both groups benefit by increased volume of patients.
Do you want to take that first, Rachel?
Sure. I mean, I would say that, you know, the participation within the Anthem Exchange products at this point is really a move in that direction in terms of navigating how to, you know, coordinate care for patients within a network environment. So I do think we're moving in that direction. It just, you know, will take time in terms of how it plays out.
Anybody else want to jump in on that? Lisa Girton?
I think my challenge is I'm not sure what meeting halfway it means. So I don't want to try to address something I'm not sure I'm fully tracking with.
What does it mean to you, meeting halfway? Sort of, you know, insurers giving up a little, providers giving up a little, consumers having more skin in the game. It's an important concept in this.
Yeah. Well, and I do think that is very much the conversation we had when we were building the Pathway Network, which is we believe that there will be people coming into the market that have been showing up for charity care that will hopefully, with a subsidy, be able to have insurance for the first time. And the meeting halfway was, will you take less in reimbursement to serve this patient than you get to serve a commercial patient if you know that, A, they're primarily people who haven't had insurance before, and, B, if you can have some assurances of volume. So in that sense, I think it was meeting halfway. Now, it could be sort of a follow-up question on the narrow network itself and whether we couldn't meet halfway to do something additional, but I'm not quite as clear on that. I do think, though, that was the spirit of the conversations, and it really did represent meeting halfway.
Sometimes it comes up, and this relates to our earlier question on competition. Rachel, this is for you again. Some people say New Hampshire has too many hospitals. I mean, 26 hospitals, it's a small state. You can drive from one end to the other in not that much time. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that there are areas of the state that are, have, good hospital networks and care delivery systems, and then there are other parts of the state that have not quite so much. But I think in the environment that we're in, what we need to be looking for is how to make sure that we're focused on our patients and really looking for creative ways to all work together to make sure that we're serving our patient population so that patients can get the care that they need in the settings that are most appropriate at the time that they need the care. And I think that's going to be a challenge as we move into the future evolutions of healthcare as it evolves.
Yeah, thanks, Rachel. Back to you, Tiffany, please.
This question came in via email, and it comes in from a woman named Deb Buxton, who wants to know, why are New Hampshire residents limited to Anthem? Who's looking over their shoulders as far as costs are concerned? Lisa Girton, would you take that one?
Well, in terms of being limited to Anthem on the exchange, it would be because the other carriers that operate in the state didn't choose to participate in the exchange this year, so I can't speak for them. I can just say that we felt that it's part of our commitment to the market. You know, we are unique already in that we serve all segments of the market, so groups and individuals, seniors, and so in 2014, once again, this is part of our industry, and we decided it was important to do. The reason there is no one else is because the other insurers, at least for 2014, didn't make that same decision. Certainly, there are plenty of people looking over our shoulders. Our regulator, the insurance department, and now the federal government looks at our products and our prices and our filing. And if we've inadvertently and unintentionally charged too much in rates for these products, there's a rebate provision under the Affordable Care Act that says we have to give that money back to our customers. So I do feel like there has been a great deal of scrutiny, even as it relates to the network. We didn't make an arbitrary decision about how far is too far to ask a patient to drive to see a doctor or to go to a hospital. We used New Hampshire's law around that access. So again, I think there's quite a bit of scrutiny and consideration that's been given to all aspects of our offering.
Lisa Kaplan, I'd love your thoughts on that too, and then I have a question for you, Steve Gerlach. Yeah.
Sure, and I was going to just add to something that I think Lisa alluded to, that in the marketplace we have one carrier, but getting back to people understanding all their options, outside of the marketplace we do have other carriers, and certainly people eligible for financial assistance, including premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions, probably need to shop through the marketplace because that's how they'll be able to access that assistance. But other people, we expect, will look at all their options, both inside the marketplace and outside the marketplace, look at Anthem plans, look at other carriers, and look at plans that have more limited networks, broader networks. So there are choices, but I think we all are hopeful and expecting that more carriers will come inside the marketplace because there is a portion of the population that truly, to be able to afford coverage, does need to access it through the marketplace.
And would the marketplace, as Lisa, be improved if New Hampshire were running its own exchanges or marketplaces versus the feds? And this was a big debate, and some people said it mattered and some people said it didn't. You said it mattered. You said it would have been better if New Hampshire had set up its own. How do you feel about that now? And you look like you want to jump in too, Steve Gerlach, but go ahead, Lisa.
I think it's hard to know for sure. We felt like at the time New Hampshire is unique, just like every state is unique, and that the insurance department and the other folks in our state who regulate insurance and who interact with the insurance industry would know best how to create a marketplace that works well for New Hampshire. But I think right now we've got a federally facilitated marketplace with some partnership aspects, and that's what we need to focus on, making it as good as possible. I think trying to, make a change mid-course, frankly, just isn't possible right now. We can transition to a state-based marketplace, but not immediately. There's some transition time for that. And I think if you look around the country, we have some state-based marketplaces that are doing remarkably well, and some that are in a similar position as the federally facilitated marketplace. So I guess my kind of reaction going forward would be that we need to look at what a transition would mean for the state and whether that's the best choice.
So we don't know for sure that it would have been better
if
New Hampshire had
done
this.
There's no way to know for sure.
What if history, Steve Gerlach? So, yeah.
I really don't have anything to add to Lisa's
Okay.
comments.
I did want to ask you a broad question, and I also want to remind our audience here in Studio D that we still have plenty of time to take your questions, so jot them down on a card and we'll come over to you. We'd love to get to as many of you as possible. Here's a question for you, Steve Gerlach, and it's kind of a broad one. So again, it's been 3 years since this law was signed. Advocates for low-income people like Lisa Kaplan Howe like the law, have been promoting the law. Rachel, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is providers, to the most part, like the law. It means more customers. Lisa Gerton, you guys have been working with this law. It's been tough for insurers, but you've been working with it. What about businesses, Steve? At their core, how do they feel about this? Is this something they would rather just not have to deal with?
I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer to that. I mean, every employer looks at this a little bit differently, has different challenges and different strengths. Certainly, there are some that that out of the gates didn't like it. A good example is the Darden restaurants example, going back to right after the election. They're the owners of Olive Garden and several other chains, Red Lobster included. And they just came out and made a political statement right after the election that said, we're going to cut all of our hourly employees back to 28 hours per week so that we don't have to offer them coverage. And, you know, in the Wall Street Journal, a lot of coverage, the whole thing. And about 3 weeks later, you see the very small retraction in that same Wall Street Journal because they got so much public pressure.
Really?
With respect to it. And, it raises that question that I brought up before, which is, what's the business decision here? What's the business decision? And so, you know, on the other hand, we've got employers that are way out in front and say, okay, this is the law, we're going to do it. And they start learning what they have to do.
We talked earlier about dumping and the concern that, you know, some businesses may say, hey, it's just a better arrangement for me to put my employees on the exchanges or the marketplaces. I wonder, though, about the idea of cutting back hours. And I think you just touched on this. The fear that the costs, the regulations of the Affordable Care Act will be so great on businesses that they'll just say, you know, I'm going to cut you back to 29 hours, Steve, because it's too expensive. It's not worth it. Or I want to hire that 50th worker. And I know you've heard of this, but under the Affordable Care Act, 50 workers means I have to comply now. So cutting back hours, not hiring that 50th person, how much do you see that happening? How much do you think that's going to happen?
I see it. I see employers considering it, looking at it, which I think they should. Anytime there's a big cost consideration to a business decision, they need to look at it. But I see very few who are actually cutting back hours. I see very few who are actually not hiring that 50th employee. And the reason for that is that there are other drivers making that decision, encouraging that decision. They're growing. For example, if we're talking about hiring that 50th employee, it's because their business is growing and they need that 50th employee's hands on the job.
Yeah. Lisa Kaplan, what do you think about that?
I think that's right.
Is that
I think
a fear?
That, I think that it's one consideration. And we see employers, the majority of employers, offering coverage today totally out of their own choice because they, like Steve said earlier, they understand it's a way of attracting employees. It's also a way of making sure your employees have access to health care so that they're healthier and more productive. I think we've experienced the same that you heard a lot at the beginning of employers saying, oh, you know, we've got to cut back hours or cut back employees. But they can't and shouldn't be making that decision just based on health insurance. And so I think certainly it's a factor, but we're not seeing a lot of that pan out.
Did you want to jump in, Lisa Gerton, on this one?
Yeah, well, I was thinking that I think we have two data points that can help on this question. And one is that upfront research that I talked about when we talk to consumers to try to inform our thinking about what kind of product to develop. At that time, we heard from employers that they were taking a wait-and-see attitude for the most part, and we didn't expect to see a high degree of dumping in that first year and maybe even into the second year. And then eventually I think it will sort itself out, and based on all of the considerations a business has to think about, we'll see different choices for different employers.
I think the second data point is New Hampshire law does give groups and individuals the right to renew their current policy at any point in time. They don't have to wait for their full year to elapse. And we've seen a lot of our small group customers take that option and lock into their plan now one more time to just get a little bit more time to see how everything will play out. And again, that sort of suggests that I don't think we're going to see a landslide of employer dumping in the early days.
Yeah, that gets to that confusion factor that Rachel talked about earlier. Let's go back to my co-host, Tiffany Eddy. Go ahead, Tiffany, please.
All right, thank you very much. This one comes in from our LFDA Facebook page from Berta Veal. She writes in, the New Hampshire population is one of the oldest in the United States. In other words, there's not a lot of young, healthy adults to help pay monthly premiums that help pay for older adults' medical bills, not yet Medicare eligible. How much did the issue of an older state population factor into the premiums and deductibles in the New Hampshire exchange plans?
Yeah. Lisa, it sounds like for you, yeah.
I would say, do the demographics of our state and the age of our state factor into premium setting? They do. I mean, they naturally do. And that's a problem that's not unique to New Hampshire, but we know that New Hampshire does have a slightly older population and that it's aging faster than the rest of the country. So is that part of what drives costs here? Yes, it is. The good news, I guess, is that we are a healthier state than many, so you could argue there's a little bit of an offset there. It didn't directly affect the development of the deductibles, as the person asked about. But yes, our demographics are a part of what drives the premiums in the state.
All right, we have a question in the audience. Sir, if you don't mind standing up and telling us your name.
I'm Representative Mel Myler.
And who would you like to direct your question toward?
I think the panel, and the question is that with Obama's announcement of extension of the current programs to try to meet his obligation that he said everybody would have their same health program, what impact do you think that will have on the program itself?
And who would you like that question for?
I think to the panel.
Why don't we start with Rachel and go on down the line there?
I think, again, our theme is confusion. So I think it does add one more level of complexity to patients and consumers navigating what their options are. I'm sure, you know, my fellow panel members will have a lot to say about the intricacies of trying to make that work within the confines of our laws, of our state laws, of just the insurance industry in general. Easier said than done. So maybe I can pass it off to Steve there for more.
Sure. I don't have a 20,000-foot view on that one, but I do have a couple of anecdotal pieces with respect to that. Clients, friends who are self-employed, who have historically had the super high deductible plans, $10,000, $15,000 deductibles, and been fairly happy with them. And I've had them go both ways on this. And I hate to equivocate, but that's where this is, at least as I'm seeing it anecdotally, that's where it's coming down. I've had some folks who come down and say, geez, thank goodness, because I really liked that. And I don't like being told what I can buy on the marketplace. I've also had other folks that say, gee, you know, now that I've looked at this plan, I'm going to get stuff that I didn't get before, like shingles vaccination and so on and so forth that I was putting off because I didn't want to pay for it. So it cuts both ways, I think.
Well, so because this idea of a substandard plan that we've been talking about, everybody has a different feeling about what's substandard.
Well,
that's what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah, and this is a great question. Thank you so much for bringing that up. And I want to hear from you too, Lisa Kaplan Howe. Big issue, and a lot of people not happy that they were told, you know, your plan's not good enough anymore. A lot of people have said, I kind of like it.
So I think in New Hampshire, the announcement that happened last week isn't a huge change because, as Lisa mentioned earlier, folks could and had the opportunity and still have the opportunity to early renew. So so there was going to already be coverage between the folks who were grandfathered and had their coverage prior to 2010 and can keep them in the long term and folks who are early renewing. I think what it means for consumers, I think what Steve said is exactly right on, that we want to make sure people are looking at all their options and understanding the details there, because for some people it may be a good choice given their personal situation to renew it one more time. And for some people, and we think a lot of people, looking at what new benefits you may be getting and looking at the cost of that, looking at whether you're eligible for financial assistance through the marketplace, it may very well make sense to make that change now. I think there's a broader question, and maybe Lisa can speak to this a little bit, about what it means for our market, that we'll have some people keeping insurance that doesn't meet all the requirements and some people moving to insurance that may be more comprehensive. Certainly that that was not news to the administration, and from what I've read, that was something they took into consideration, and there are other provisions they're putting in place to try to make sure that that balance is maintained and we don't have the segmenting of the market, but that's something that I think we'll all keep an eye on as well.
Yeah, it's been a political problem, hasn't it? You know, people being told you can keep your insurance. Oops, no, you can't.
Well, so I think... there are, let's look at the individual market, which is not terribly huge in New Hampshire. It's about 30,000 people in total, and most of them are with Anthem. Some of those people had elected grandfathering way back. They held on to the plan that they had when the ACA passed in 2010, and that's a block of several thousand people. What we reminded people in a recent mailing is something that I mentioned earlier, and that is, if you really like your plan and want to hang on to it, renewing it early is a way to do that. It accomplishes very much the same thing. So members have through November 30th to let us know, yes, I'd like to hang on to that individual plan that I have, and then they'll have a new policy effective date of December 1, 2013 through 11/30/2014. So that was something we'd already communicated. Again, that's allowable under the law. We just wanted to make sure that it was one of the many options that we spelled out for people. Now that this further information is available, now that the president has made that announcement, we are looking at it to see if we should do anything additional. But what I really want to underscore is that way to hang on to your plan is already there. And if we have a member who wants to, the surest way to do that is to let us know by November 30th. And the rest gets very, very complicated. So I'm not sure if we will ultimately decide to do anything further. But I do believe that what we've already offered accomplishes very much what this is all about anyway.
Thank you. We have another question that came in through email from Bert Cox, who starts off by making an assertion. Obviously, the government, the insurance companies, and the lawyers have made a mess of the health care that we currently have for ourselves. For example, one-stop shopping at your local physician is dead. The modus operandi is to send the patients to as many specialists as possible, do every conceivable test, milk the system, spread the reduced liability, and if in doubt, operate. What are we doing to address these fundamental, underlying structural and operational problems of the healthcare system, as opposed to putting lipstick on the pig? And I think this one could go to the entire panel.
Why don't we start with you, Steve, Rachel, Lisa, and Lisa. Yeah, lipstick on a pig.
Speaking as a person who has occasionally had to put lipstick on a pig. Not quite sure how to get into that one, but I'll start again by looking at Massachusetts, because that was the model for the federal reform. Last year, Massachusetts acknowledged that the Romney Care, so-called Romney Care, had not really accomplished much in the way of cost savings, and passed a new set of reforms attempting to address the cost issue, and including cost comparison and data collection and different panels addressing different aspects of the cost. It's much too early to tell whether that is whether that's going to be effective, but I think that it's well known at this point that this isn't the final solution, and we need to look at further reforms in the future.
Yeah, and I like this question because, you know, it asks, are we really dealing with the underlying structural problems in the healthcare system. What do you think, Rachel?
I would say that this particular part of what we're talking about today, so the Affordable Care Act and providing access to insurance coverage for all individuals within the country, it's just part of the overall conversation around healthcare. Healthcare has become, you know, more and more complicated every year. I don't think there's any argument that the fee-for-service model that we are currently largely under is not the solution and won't help us to get where we need to go. We really need to be continuing to take steps towards fee-for-value, looking at how we deliver care throughout our organizations with healthcare in general, and looking for ways that best meet our patients' needs, controlling costs and providing appropriate care, evidence-based medicine. That's all very important in terms of how we get into the future state. I do think that this is an important part of helping us move towards that future, though, and I think it will only serve us as we make that journey.
And I want you two on this pig lipstick issue. But Rachel, a question for you real quick, if I could, please. You've talked a couple times about moving away from fee-for-service, fee-for-value. Some people say that's code word for health maintenance organizations, which were not very popular after a while. People felt like their care was restricted and they had to fight to see who they wanted to see. So how is fee-for-value, to use your word, different from the old-fashioned HMO that was kind of discredited?
There are many ways to do, or many evolutions of fee-for-value. You know, capitation is those of us who remember capitation and those kinds of budgets for patient care that were rather restrictive and didn't quite work as well as they were anticipated to work. I think the fee-for-value approach, and there are multiple models across the country that are being looked at and studied and experimented with very closely, really look at warrantying care, and they look at outcomes and quality measures built into the care that's provided. So it's not just trying to restrict care or drive care to a certain location or direction, but it's also looking for the quality outcomes associated with care. You can't do one without the other. Even if care is cost effective, if it doesn't produce the quality outcomes that are necessary, it really has no value to it. So I think that's the difference in some of the models that are starting to be experimented with around the country and that we're driving toward, is really looking for outcomes and quality measures, as Lisa mentioned earlier.
And Lisa Kaplan-Howe, Lisa Girton, very quickly on this gentleman's question, are we really dealing with structural issues here or just pretending?
Sure. So I think that there's no doubt that our healthcare system was not working for people, was not working broadly, and something needed to be done. And I agree that this is a step in the right direction, but this is, I don't think anybody thinks this is it. I don't think anybody ever thought this would be it. And some of the things that Rachel was just talking about are pilots through the Affordable Care Act, and the Affordable Care Act is providing funding for those pilots to see how they work, see whether they work, see how to make them as effective as possible. And then the hope is with time, they become more broadly integrated into our healthcare delivery system.
Okay, and back to Tiffany Eddy, please.
This one just came over through email, and this person writes, okay, so we're getting going on the Affordable Health Care Act. Now, when are we going to start making the actual costs of health care transparent? Like, you know, when you hear about being charged $7 for aspirin tablets. There are lots more items like that which we do not know the true costs of, and we should know. Why don't we start with Rachel for that one?
Sure. That's a perennial problem in terms of transparency within the healthcare system. And you hear the horror stories all the time about a charge versus what a payment is associated with care that's delivered. And it is true that, some of what are the kind of the gross charges that are charged for any particular service or item that's delivered within a healthcare system have really, there's a chasm now between that charge and what the actual payment is. And I think, again, as we drive more to fee for value, those incremental services or charges become less important or will become less important in the new world, because the incentives will change in terms of not being, you know, paid for every single item or service that's received, but really getting reimbursed more for outcomes. And that's really what will solve this problem, I think, as this evolves.
Transparency is probably really important to insurers, Lisa Girton.
It is. And what I would say is for the past couple of years, we've been very, very focused, obviously, on preparing for the Affordable Care Act. But the other two most critical strategic initiatives we've worked on have to do with the very things we're talking about, which would be learning from our medical home pilots and bringing that into our payment innovation programs and bringing real transparency tools to our customers, not only giving them information, but giving them a reason to care, incentives to actually become cost and quality sensitive shoppers. So those are very important things that the person is asking about, and they are a top priority.
Here's my last question for all of you. And again, you've been really generous with your time. How is this Affordable Care Act, the success of it, going to be measured? When people look back at this 2 years, 3 years from now, how are they going to measure, yeah, that was a success, or no, it wasn't? Lisa Kaplan-Howell, I'll start with you.
I think that's a big question. It's something that we all grapple with. I think most primarily people will look at how many people got covered, newly covered for it, and how their coverage is working for them, and also how much it costs. But I do think that that the analysis goes deeper than that. That's probably the analysis. People want to understand how it impacts their lives. I think many of us on this panel and otherwise will look at also the impact on our healthcare system and the health of our healthcare system going forward and the impacts of that on our state and our economy more broadly.
How about you next, Rachel, please?
I would agree with, you know, everything Lisa said. I think we'll measure by how patients are able to access the healthcare system and get the care that they need. I also think that we'll have a lot more data and information to collect around and to look at around prevention and what role the core preventions components of the Affordable Care Act, you know, make on the population at large, too.
So if people really do have great preventative care, we should be able to see
right.
in a couple years.
Right.
We had fewer heart attacks.
Mm-hmm.
We had fewer
mm-hmm.
problems with diabetes and so
right.
forth. Steve, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. I would sum it up slightly different. I would say there's really four factors that folks are going to look at. They're going to look at, have we improved access? Have we decreased costs? Have we kept quality high or improved quality? And what's this a little bit more difficult to obtain? Do people like it? Are people happy with it?
Well, and you keep pointing out the Massachusetts model, and people have been watching that, and they have done well on some of those measures, but the cost has still been a factor. Yeah,
yes.
How about you, Lisa Girton? How are we going to measure the success of this in 3 years, say?
Yeah, I think that it's been summed up nicely. It starts with access. The idea is that if you give people better access to health insurance, they will be able to access health care and therefore live healthier, happier, and more productive lives. So I think there's a big picture we have to keep our eye on here. And in the short term, I really hope people will get out and understand how many options they do have, try to avail themselves of the information that's out there, and make the right choice for themselves and their families.
All right, and that wraps things up. We ask that you stick around for some food and fellowship in Studio D after the show. Also, an edited version of tonight's broadcast will air during the exchange on Friday, November 29th. That's the day after Thanksgiving. I want to thank our guests today, Lisa Girton, Lisa Kaplan-Howell, Steve Gerlach, and Rachel Verville. Thanks especially to my co-host, Tiffany Eddy, and our partners at the Live Free or Die Alliance. I'm Laura Kanoy. Thanks for joining us on this virtual town hall.